You're listening to Leicester Build Back Better Stories. Conversations about how communities across Leicester are planning for change following the pandemic. Over six programmes, we'll hear from people at the forefront of civic society in Leicester, and we'll find out how they are planning to do things differently in response to Leicester's extended lockdown. For further information about each of the topics covered in the programmes and extended versions of the conversations, go to the Leicester Stories website, leicesterstories.uk. Recovering from the coronavirus pandemic is going to take some effort and determination, which means we need to rethink what and how we approach the support that is available to people across Leicester. There'll be no returning to the old normal, though we don't yet know what the new normal needs to be. I'm Rob Watson, and over the summer, I've been chatting with people who work for charities and civic society organisations in Leicester about how they are planning to build back better and what we need to do to be ready for the next set of community challenges. Over six programmes, we're hearing from people across Leicester who've been telling us what they think about the city and in what way they think life in Leicester can be improved. In this fourth episode, we'll hear from Charlotte Roby-Turner, who's an education support champion with Leicestershire Cares, who helps young people who've been in care to gain employment. We'll also be hearing from Shim Gooch, who worked for Reaching People supporting community leadership training. To start things off, Leicester Stories community reporter Ryan Clayton has been out in the city, asking people what they think of Leicester and what they think makes the city unique.
Hi mate, have you got a moment to answer a couple of questions?
No worries.
No worries. Sorry, have you got a moment to answer a couple of questions?
What's it about?
I'm just asking people about Leicester.
It's all right. It could be a lot better.
What do you think could be improved?
A bit more tidier. It's a bit of a ruddy mess in some places. But I know that they are trying to, you know, like to do it up. You know, like in certain areas, but it could be a little bit cleaner.
Yeah. Is there anything about the city that you feel makes it unique or stand out as a city? Or do you think it feels just like another city in England?
I've not really been to many cities in England.
Oh, right. Fair enough then.
So, I know it's good because we've got, you know, like the king in the... in the cathedral,
Richard III,
that's good. That should get people in, but they could do with doing a lot down that area, down there.
Oh, down by Charles Street.
Yeah, that could do with tidying up and getting more things going down that area. You see, I used to work down that road, and it was really, really thriving. Everything's gone.
Yeah. Have you heard that slogan at all? Build back better.
No.
If you saw it on social media, what do you think it might mean?
I assume building back communities and businesses to improve on the last 18 months or whatever.
Is there anything about Leicester you'd like to see improved now that we're coming out of coronavirus?
Essentially, just try to get people back out into the streets, shopping, and just businesses get back on the feet again, really. If you look around, most of the streets are pretty dire in terms of the shops that have closed down, businesses that have moved out, or, you know, so I think it's tried to maybe look at new ways of getting people back into the town, you know, and back into the cities, because people obviously have become quite used to being at home or doing other things.
I love Leicester, yeah. I've lived here all my life, so I love it. It's not unique, but it's very multicultural. I think everywhere you go, you'll find, like, every colour type person. And I love that. I mean, I'm not going to say that people are the friendliest, but as in, like, I feel like there's lots to do. Like, the city centre's fun. Coming to city centre, to High Cross, going shopping often, all the time, actually. And obviously, I live not too far, and I feel like everything's pretty close. Train station's really close as well. City centre, so it's easy to just hop on a train, go anywhere. There's always some construction going on, always, and I don't really know why. So I wish they would keep it how it was before and not do all the new modern buildings. I feel like it's fine how it is.
I used to study here, so I'm not from Leicester. I'm from Birmingham, but I studied here like 10 years ago. It's good to be back, I guess. It's a nice, cute little city. You have what you need. It's quieter than Birmingham, but that has its own charm, I guess. Yeah. Well, first, it's more ethnically diverse, which is kind of cute. I don't know. I just have a lot of memories here, a lot of food places. Like, every time, whenever I do come back to Leicester, I always try and trace back all the food places I used to go to as a uni student. And it's always nice just going back, seeing that these places are still, because most of them are independents, seeing that they're still going strong, still have their, loyal clientele, still serving the same food that they did 10, 11, 12 years ago. It's just, in Birmingham, because it's a bigger city, you have a higher turnover of independents because, they just don't last. And they're often replaced by, your Nando's, your McDonald's. But here it's good to see that even on the high street you have, your independents. And that they do last just as long as sort of multinational chains. So I guess that's probably a cute thing about Leicester compared to Birmingham.
Probably something for the homeless people.
Homeless people as well.
Because I do see a lot of people around.
Yeah, same. I do see.
Don't know if there is something for them. I'm not sure because we don't know yet. Yeah. And if there is, then why they're still in the streets, why they're still in the town, sit in the corner.
Yeah.
I was talking to some of them and they said they charge you some money, but then if they don't have the money, well, how are they supposed to go in there and how they're supposed to afford it? So if they improve that bit, then it'd be less. Obviously, it's better for them people to go in and then sort it out, isn't it? Yeah, other than that, I'm not sure.
So my name's Charlotte Roby Turner. I work for Leicestershire Cares and I'm their head of children and young people. I lead a team of workers who work both in school and youth work settings. So we have projects where we link business volunteers, with students in school to help with their reading, maths and employability. But we also have a set of projects with young people who are out of education, employment and training and have barriers to getting into those opportunities for whatever reason it might be that they have experience with the criminal justice system, experience with the care system, they might be refugees, asylum seekers, or they might just have mental health problems or learning difficulties, whatever it is. We have a number of different projects that can sort of help them overcome those barriers and make steps towards their goals. It's been challenging, but I think as an organisation we've been really creative and sort of flexible in terms of the way that we've been delivering our support. So we were already kind of geared up. We all had like laptops and like online documents and that kind of stuff. So as soon as lockdown hit, we all started working from home and we immediately could set up online support sessions for our young people. We could loan out laptops because we already had them because we used them in the office with young people to help them job search. So we loaned them out to them so they could continue doing that from home. They could do online functional skills courses. We did a whole range of like wellbeing sessions on Zoom. So we had group cooking sessions where we dropped off the ingredients to our young people. Then they all came on and each of them chose a different recipe each week that they wanted to cook. So that was called Quarantine Cooks. And that was really, really successful. Fitness things, quizzes, the whole Zoom thing. We did it with our young people. And a lot of the focus really was just keeping them engaged, keeping them feeling positive and sort of connected to other people. We work with a lot of young people who are really isolated. So we have care leavers who live in bed sits. We have young mums who are living in mother-baby units where they were trapped in like a one-bed flat with their 2-3-year-olds or 2-2-year-olds, which was exciting. So a lot of young people who really, really, really struggled with social isolation and their mental health and really concerned about what it meant for their future, what it meant for their children's future. So I think just keeping them kind of engaged with us and with other young people was sort of our main focus, really. It was a lot of ups and downs, really. So some, I think, were really, really anxious at first about contracting COVID. So obviously they were very worried about going out. So actually, in a way, when the lockdown happened, a lot of that pressure was sort of removed. And some of our young people don't like going out. They don't like the sort of social pressure of going to groups and seeing people and the thought of having to go to work or go to school or any kind of course is quite difficult for them. So in a way they were sort of in their element, just kind of engaging online. But I think after the novelty of that wore off, I think the reality of the situation hit, and that was when we saw a lot of our young people take a turn for the worse in terms of their mental health. We did a lot of kind of sort of phone sessions, online sessions, doorstep sessions where we'd go and just drop, you know, as we dropped ingredients off of the cooking, checking in with them, seeing how they were doing. We created packs as well to keep them entertained. So especially if they had kids, we put together like activity packs and gave them to them each week so that they had something to keep the children entertained, and gave them tips for like how they could do bits of exercise at home and, you know, mindfulness and those kinds of things to keep them sort of occupied. But also works a lot with our partners like Let's Talk Wellbeing and other kind of mental health services to sort of get them counselling if we felt like they were really in need of that kind of more intensive support. But obviously that's hard to sort of get young people into because there's such a long queue and waiting list for a lot of that. So yeah, it was, I think some of them, they were very good at talking to us if they had issues and they wanted to kind of get things off their chest or talk through a problem that they've got at home. Others are kind of a bit more reserved and it takes more kind of relationship building with them before they'll open up to you. But we're lucky that I have really, really good team members in my team that have that kind of connection with young people. So I think we're a source of support for a lot of those young people when they didn't want to turn to anyone else, actually. So it was positive in that sort of respect, but challenging in many other ways. We get young people referred to us often, and as part of that process we sit down with them and have an open discussion about key areas of their lives that we might be able to support them with, and one of those key areas is mental health. So sort of right from the get-go we speak to our young people about how they feel in terms of their mental health and well-being, if they have any kind of diagnosed mental health conditions, but also it's, I think the main thing that we do is just really get to know our young people on a personal sort of level, and we can see changes in their behaviour, changes in their demeanour. So they might be a bit more withdrawn, or they might just be a bit more chaotic in kind of their behaviour, or erratic in terms of what they're doing. And we can pick up on those things and know that something's not quite right, and sort of take them to one side, talk to them about what's going on outside of like our work and what things are like at home, and, you know, kind of talk to them in that way. So a lot of it is, I think, for them just feeling like they've got someone that they can talk to about those issues. In terms of knowing when someone's struggling, some of them are very open, like I say, about having mental health problems, and some of them are like advocates and peer supporters for that kind of issue, which is great. But others, you just kind of have to pick up on changes in their behaviour and the way that they're presenting themselves, the way that they're talking or not talking, engaging or not engaging, which is where it was more difficult on Zoom, because a lot of them didn't like putting their videos on. So if you can't see them, it's a lot more difficult to kind of pick up on those sort of behavioural cues or those visual cues as to how a young person's feeling, which is why my team still went out and sort of met them on the doorstep and did those kind of socially distanced sessions with them as well on a one-to-one basis, just because you just can't tell sometimes from how someone sounds on Zoom as to how they're actually feeling and whether they are okay. There is a kind of sort of assumption now that young people feel like it's more accepted to kind of talk about mental health, and particularly young men. You know, I know there's been lots of campaigns around encouraging young men to talk about, you know, how they're feeling, and know that it's okay if they're not feeling, you know, positive and that they need some support with their mental health. But it really does vary from person to person. I think for some young people, they've found that quite empowering, and they think that they can kind of talk about how they're feeling, and they talk to their peers about it, and they will, you know, confidently come to you and say, I have anxiety, I have depression, these are the things that I kind of have to deal with on a day-to-day basis. Whereas others are just very, very insular, partly sometimes because of their mental health kind of condition. They don't necessarily want to sort of talk about themselves even, let alone sort of how they're feeling. And it is really difficult. I think one of the reasons why young people don't always talk about their mental health is because there is still quite a lot of stigma, and it does put a label on young people, you know, and they're kind of potentially always seen through that lens of having mental health problems. And then, like, oh, so-and-so's like that because she's got depression, or because she's got anxiety, or whatever, you know, condition it might be that they have. the way that we work at Leicester Cares is very young person focused. So we have a kind of participatory approach. We like to start where the young person is and kind of build up from there. So as I say, we'll have those initial kind of discussions about where they're at, how they're feeling, what support they kind of want from us. Some of them are quite actively come to us and say, I'm really struggling with my mental health and I really want some support with that. Now, we're not mental health experts. We have partners who, like I say, that we kind of refer our young people to get that specialist support if we and they agree that they sort of would benefit from that. But I think from us, it's we do work with young people, but they're kind of young adults and we treat them in that way. So we work with 16 to 25 year olds broadly, sort of 15, 16 to 24, 25. And we really start from their kind of position, and our work is not about us going out and doing everything for them and then getting them into a right position. It's all about empowering them to take sort of steps themselves and kind of being able to take responsibility and accountability for their own kind of actions and their progress and where they're going to get to. So you've probably heard of us developing our Power to Change model over the last year. So that's the kind of approach that we take with our young people. So we start with the first stage is like power within. So that might be getting them to think about what their goals are and what the barriers are towards achieving those goals, and then helping them to deal with those barriers. So it's often quite practical things around their housing, their finances, their relationship, you know, just where they are in that moment in time and what is kind of causing them issues, maybe affecting their mental health, you know, those kinds of things, and really just kind of working with them to identify those and take steps to sort of make it so that they can manage them. I mean, they won't obviously just disappear overnight, but as long as they feel like they're on top of it and they can manage it and they're sort of more in control of things and not just responding to stuff that's happening to them on a day-to-day basis. And then once that's kind of sort of, we can move to power with, which is more working with them to build connections, get experience, gain skills. So it might be linking them with our businesses and getting a bit of input into thinking about what they might want to do as a career, getting some work experience, doing some skills development, doing some courses, you know, those kinds of things to sort of build up their kind of sense of self-worth, I guess, and kind of self-esteem. And then the power two bit is when they start taking action for themselves. So it might be getting into work, it might be getting into training, or it might be that they've identified an issue like mental health or the environment or whatever it might be that is important to them, and they feel able to kind of take action to sort of make changes around that. So they might become a peer advocate for a mental health service, or they might I don't know, want to run a webinar about environmental issues, or what is the Leicester's kind of stance on climate change and what can we do to kind of make the city greener, or you know, a few different things like that. We had a project where we got some funding from the Violence Reduction Network to work with some of our care leavers about how we can divert young people away from crime, and they went through a really, really good like discussion process and realised that it was the violence that they'd experienced at school through bullying that made them more likely to get involved in that kind of activity like in later years. So they decided they wanted to put on an anti-bullying session, so they've developed like a whole anti-bullying sort of information thing that's going on Leicester City Council's website, because they have an anti-bullying part of their website, but mentions nothing about looked after children or care experienced young people. We're developing some training for teachers and things that they want to deliver in schools, so things like that. So that's a kind of that's where we'd like them to get to the point where they can sort of identify and take action for things themselves. So to kind of pull it all the way back to the sort of thing you were talking about, I think it's kind of not just doing things for young people, it's giving them the skills and the confidence that they can do things for themselves, and that really feeds into, I think, managing their mental health, their well-being, finding things, techniques that work for them. It was a huge time of change. I mean, we just kind of completely changed the way that we delivered our work, that we developed our work, that we engaged with our young people. We like to work with them to find out what it is that they want from us. So we try to involve them in developing, you know, new activities, new programs, new projects, whatever it is that they might be interested in. And we worked with our young people a lot to kind of get them to think about, what do you actually need from us right now? Like, we're here to help you. And they came up with the idea of quarantine cooks. And, you know, they said, oh, we'd really want the fitness things. We kind of put it on for them, but they were the ones that were sort of saying, we'd really like this, and we responded to that. And actually, that's really important as well, I think. What we learned is it's all very well, and I think this is the problem that we have too often, is that organisations go out and they say to young people or whoever their target audience is, sort of, what do you need, what do you want, what are the problems at the minute? And young people again and again and again say, this is what the problem is, this is what I find, this is what I think, but then they see absolutely nothing change as a result, or no response to that, or never hear from them again. And I think that that's where we try not to do that. You know, if we go and engage with our young people or consult with them, we always feedback to them, like, this is what we've done as a result. Here's the session that you wanted. We couldn't put this on for these reasons. And I think it's... We did some sessions with them when we were setting up a young person steering group for our children and young people team, and said to them, how do you know that you're being listened to? And they say it's because something changes. And if you don't make that change, they don't feel listened to, and they won't engage again in any kind of consultation thing because they just don't see any point in it. And I think that's the problem that we get with quite a lot of our young people, especially those that have been through formal systems like the care system or the criminal justice system, where they've been engaged in, you know, kind of consultation events about, like, what could be better, what could be changed. And they say, what's the point? Because nothing's gonna change as a result. I don't know. I think a lot of them often struggle to articulate that themselves, you know, in the first instance, because they're kind of dealing with so many challenges on a day-to-day basis. And this is one of the things that we often have to work with them quite a lot on when they first join us, is that their focus is very much day-to-day. You know, it's sort of like, how am I going to get my food tonight? How am I going to get my kids to school? How am I going to do this? I need to top up the electricity. I need to do this. I need to make sure that my TV license is paid. And oh no, the fridge is broken. And how am I going to get a new fridge? And that kind of stuff. And it's very, very rooted in kind of what those issues are. So at that first power within stage, a whole lot of the work that we do with them is trying to get those things, like I say, under control and managed, so that they can start to think about why. It's when they start getting to that power two stage, like, actually, why are you in that situation and other people aren't? So, you know, these guys down the road, they're fine, they've got a good job, they're doing well, they're progressing, they've got the money that they need on a day-to-day basis, but you don't. And what's the difference? Is it because you've been through the care system, or is it the stigma attached to that, or is it, you know, the lack of opportunities that you've had, or is it because you had 4 social workers within 18 months and you didn't connect with any of them? Was it because you were moved 6 times in your GCSE year? Or, you know, getting them to think about those things and then identifying small sort of changes to those kind of systems. I think the kind of change that young people want to see really depends on their experiences and what they've been through. So some of our care leavers will have very specific ideas about what needs to change about the care system. Some of our young people who have been through the criminal justice system might have some very specific ideas about what needs to change with probation or with the support that they've received, you know, post-release or, you know, while they're on caution and those kinds of things. And I think a lot of it, we also, because we work with businesses so much as well, is trying to get them to think about what do businesses need to do differently and how can we make, you know, local employers be more inclusive in terms of their recruitment and their support for staff, so that you feel able to kind of make those steps into it. So we've taken some of our young people onto workshops with our businesses and helped them kind of really reflect on their sort of practices. So we've got a business mentoring program at the minute, which has been really good, because we got some young people said to us, oh, we'd quite like to have like a mentor, because it's nice to have you guys, but you're my worker, and I, just having another adult in my life that I can sort of run ideas past or get some advice from, or really help me think like towards this specific goal, how can I kind of get there? And so we got a group of our young people together and sort of said, okay, so what would you want from a mentoring program? And then we got a group of businesses together and said, what do you think a mentoring program could do for your staff, but also for the young people that you support, and what issues might you see with that, what training and things might you need? And then we brought them together and they could share those ideas between them, and we came up with a program which we, you know, we trained not just the mentors but also the mentees about how to be a good mentee and turn up on time and engage and do things in between sessions and covered off all of, you know, businesses' concerns around safeguarding and, you know, professional boundaries and those kinds of things. And we've got now a nice, like, really good, successful sort of programme. We've had a few young people kind of go through it and really benefit from the advice that those business mentors were able to give them. So I think it's... But those young people that were involved in that app were kind of at that point where they'd got through some of those more pressing issues and were able to think, actually, what I really need next is this, and then felt able to take part in kind of shaping that and making that change kind of happen for them in their lives. So I think that's where the power to change model works really well, that you've got to get young people to a certain point where they can sort of enact change, I guess, if that makes sense. But yeah, I mean, I think if you speak to young people, mental health is a really big one. They want better mental health support. is huge for a lot of them. If they're parents and they've got young children, then support around childcare and things, because that's a huge barrier to them getting into education, let alone work. You know, and the balancing the cost of childcare, and a lot of them don't have like parents or grandparents that people rely on, you know, to kind of have their kids. So yeah, there's a lot of change, but I think it's just being meaningfully consulted with and then having their feedback taken on board is a really big one. I think when we're working with businesses, getting the young people to come often triggers that light bulb moment in a business where they're like, I've never even thought of it like that. Like, they bring a totally different perspective from what a business... I mean, I say a business, they're all individuals, they're all, you know, I mean, they're signed up to Leicester Cares, so they're all very engaged and willing to contribute back to the local community. That's why they're a member of ours. That's why they, you know, give their employees time to volunteer with us and learn from us and learn from our young people. So, you know, they're very willing and open to sort of listen. But I think the mentoring program is a really good idea where I think, you know, the businesses were thinking like, oh, yeah, this would be really good for the young people and it can only be a positive thing. But, you know, the young people were talking about what if you match me with a mentor and I meet them and I don't like them, and then do I have to put up with them for, you know, 6 months, or can I change, and or what if something, they say something and it makes me uncomfortable, or, you know, and then they were like, oh, I can really see now why this is such a big decision for a young person to make, whereas I think before they just thought we'd be like, here's your mentor, off you go and enjoy it, and they didn't realise sort of all the different kinds of considerations that a young person has before entering something like that kind of program. So I do think it is, you know, we always try and get our young people involved in things, because we all my staff are really experienced of working with young people. You know, I've got staff with many years of supporting local community groups, or you know, young people out in the community, or working with students. But And actually, a couple of them have lived experience themselves of, like, with work, being in the position of the groups that they work with. But I don't. I'm not a care leaver. I've not been involved in the criminal justice system. So who am I to kind of stand there and say, oh, this is what care leavers need, or this is what, you know, I can say this is what young people have told me, this is what research says. But having a young person there who's kind of lived it and can kind of really reflect on it and really go back through their lives and think about, oh, actually, this thing really worked well for me. Like, this helped me do this. And then this was like a disaster and, you know, sent me back like 2 years because I couldn't finish my degree, or I couldn't do, you know, that job that I really wanted to do for whatever ridiculous reason, that I couldn't get the money to travel there or whatever it is. And that's when they can start pinpointing those little changes that can make a really big difference for a young person's life. And I think that's when people go, ah, there's actually some really tangible things that we can do to make a difference. Yeah, I think working with businesses is great because it's like a totally different kind of perspective. I think a lot of organisations either in the voluntary sector are a bit afraid of approaching businesses, or they're kind of daunted by the prospect, or they're just not really considered in a lot of like plans, I guess, locally. The local authorities are thinking of things like businesses have a very particular role around, you know, bringing in income to the city, or, you know, generating jobs and that kind of thing. But we think about it in a quite holistic way, I guess, and a very proactive way that businesses can actually, you know, really work with young people to help them get the skills and things that they need in order to progress. And so that's, I really enjoy that part of working at Leicestershire Cares and kind of how we make those connections. And it can really, it adds so much value to what we do on our projects, having the business element to it. Not just because obviously then you've got someone who works in a company who can tell young people, like, this is actually what an employer expects and this is how you should apply for jobs and those kind of really basic things. It's just building those connections for young people that they just don't have. They don't have, you know, an auntie that works in the hospital that can get them a work placement for 6 weeks. They don't have dad who's a high-level senior manager at whatever retail company might... You know, they don't have those kind of family or social connections where they can just kind of get those bits of experience or those skills or that advice or even just bounce ideas around about what job they might enjoy or, you know, how their values as a person fits with the companies or, you know, those kinds of things that a lot of us, I think, take for granted. So bringing that into our work, I think, just adds so much value. It's really good.
You're listening to Leicester Build Back Better Stories. Conversations about how communities across Leicester are planning for change following the pandemic. For further information about each of the topics covered in the programmes and extended versions of the conversations, go to Leicester Stories website, leicesterstories.uk.
I don't suppose you've got a moment to answer some questions.
That's what it's about.
We're just walking around asking people how they felt about the city.
Yeah. I'm very pleased. It looks so vibrant at the minute. It's lovely to see people around. We walked down past the cathedral earlier, and it just looked fantastic. Where did we have coffee? St Martin's looked fantastic with the food stalls and things. Yeah, so yeah, very, very impressed at the minute. It's all green, it's all clean.
Is there anything about the city you feel makes it unique, stand out against other cities in England?
Well, it's well known for its ethnic diversity, so I mean, they do celebrate that, don't they? So the food and the cultures, yeah, definitely makes it stand out.
Yeah. Anything you'd perhaps like to see improved about the city?
General cleanliness. It's quite good at the minute, but yeah, it does get a little bit scruffy in places, so.
It's nice. Yeah, it's good. A lot to do when you need it.
Is there anything about the city that makes it feel unique for you?
No, not really. It's like a lot of other places. It's a lot smaller than, say, Nottingham and stuff like that, so it feels a lot better sometimes. I mean, it's easier to walk to. Yeah, depends where you live, obviously.
Is there anything you'd like to see improved then about the city?
Probably a little bit more entertainment, you know, like streetwise and stuff like that. Similar like today, yeah, with a lot more things going on to get people out and about.
And is there anywhere in the city that you can go? Anything that you do in the city that makes it feel like home for you?
Well, there's like lots of places that you can go and eat and things like that, you know. Yeah, it's quite nice.
It's very diverse, isn't it? Yeah, loads of different shops, and especially where I'm staying in a town, you don't have that much variety and like food-wise. And I'm from Nepal, so in terms of like that part of the world, you know, you have like loads of food. It's like, sometimes you feel like you're not in the UK, you know, some parts of it, but yeah.
Fantastic. Yeah. Thank you so much, mate.
All right, mate.
No worries.
Take care.
Have a nice day.
Yeah, Leicester is a good city to live in. It's multicultural, things are just nearby compared to other places I've lived in. Yeah, so, yeah.
Is there anything about the city that makes it feel unique and stand out in your mind?
Basically, I think, like, when you look at things like universities, they are just nearby. They're not far from the town. So, for me, it's that, yeah.
Anything you'd like to see different about the city, improved?
Probably the buildings within the city. They look not that really up to date. So, if that could be changed, yeah.
Yeah. And finally, is there anything about the city, anywhere you can go, anything you do, that makes it feel like home for you, gives you a sense of community?
Basically the parks, like Victoria Park here. Yeah. I think that is that for me, yeah.
Thank you so much, mate.
Okay. All right,
have a nice day.
Yeah, it's all right. It's much, yeah.
Is there anything about it that makes it feel unique to you when you walk around?
Very dirty.
It's not that bad, is it?
Is there anywhere you go, anything that you do that makes it feel like home for you and you get a sense of community or
football.
Belong from?
Yeah. The football games.
Yeah.
Isn't it Harry, yeah?
No, I'm not a Leicester fan.
I am.
Yeah.
What about improvements then? Is there anything about the city you'd like to see changed?
A bit more cleaning. Yeah. Yeah. Tied it up a bit more.
So I'm Shim Gooch. I work for Reaching People in Leicester, which is a consortium of member charities. And my role is a project manager, and I've been brought in to work on a 3-year leadership training project. So that involves the design and delivery and evaluation of training programs or interventions for the voluntary sector, because there was some research done before I started back in the beginning of 2020 or the end of 2019 that was around how can we sustain the voluntary sector and how can we make it more resilient. And one of the biggest things that came out of it was the lack of training of the grassroots, people that are in the grassroots sort of positions. How do we create the next leaders? And also very much about, you know, where's the succession planning? Why don't people stay in the sector? Why do they do a bit of voluntary work or start off and then they go and work somewhere else in a different sector? How can we sort of sustain that? So this project was very much around starting to empower and sort of look at behaviours and how we can sort of coach or mentor people into staying in the sector. And I think it's about raising awareness. The biggest thing I noticed was people don't really know what the sector can give them. You know, the everyday person that's out there thinks of the voluntary sector as, you know, working for a charity or working unpaid. You know, it's that perception, and how do we change that perception? I don't come from a voluntary background. I used to work in retail management. You know, I've spent a lot of time around people and planning, succession planning and developing teams. And I've worked my way from bottom up kind of thing. So, and I've worked for different organisations with different cultures. So all of that's coming quite useful, coming into this sector with sort of fresh eyes. There's a lot of challenges. So what we've done with this project, we've sort of started at the foundations. We've sort of started some partnerships and therefore training programs for different levels, so people that are grassroots levels that are just getting into it or just want to volunteer, don't want to do a lot, but we can still give them something in terms of free training. And it's about empowering, it's about giving them confidence, and it's about getting them to think about a little bit outside of where they are, like what impact are they actually making. And a lot of them make a lot more impact than they realize, and that's quite, you know, interesting and quite eye-opening for them, because you see the excitement and that buzz, and that's what you want to build on. It's that core, like, you know, actually I am making a difference, how can I take that further, how can I help my community? Because that's what it's all about. Without the communities, there's no voluntary sector. Without the voluntary sector, there's no business, kind of thing. So it all sort of ties in together. So yeah, ultimately it's a 3-year project. We're sort of halfway through. We've offering free training. We're currently working on trustee training. It's not about, there's a lot of training out there, don't get me wrong, but it's about behaviours and leadership. How are we impacting and being aware of that? So yeah, that's all in a nutshell. That's what I'm doing. I actually secured this role during the pandemic. So when I came into it, the pandemic was already happening. So that's the pandemic sort of hit in March, wasn't it? Lockdown was in March, and I joined in August. So it very much was, this is the research we've got, what can we do with it? And it was like we had the funding secured, so it was not about we just wait it out. It was like we should still be able to do something. And all the face-to-face delivery and all the areas that had been identified, we had to be quite agile with it. We had to think, how can we be flexible that we can work this while the pandemic's happening but still utilise it when and if it's over? Otherwise, you know, we're sort of having to balance resources, what capacity is and what we can actually physically deliver. It was tough. The biggest thing was upskilling people to be able to use technology. And even those that could use technology sort of still needed the confidence to use it to deliver to other people. Reaching communities was really difficult. How do you get, you know, how do you let people know you're doing training? And especially because we're aiming it at the voluntary sector and the sort of organisations that are quite especially during the pandemic, they were quite under pressure. Suddenly they had to up their game because they were having to deliver, you know, food projects. They had funding that they were trying to reach communities that were missing out. And their priority was not training. My priority was training, not theirs. So it was very much around, okay, we need to spend this time sort of reassessing what the research told us, because is that still even relevant anymore? And we found in some aspects the broad themes were still relevant, but everyone's priorities had changed. So we changed how we introduced the project. Instead of doing a big launch and a big, you know, hoo-ha, look at all this we've got, it was very much slowly and one by one. So we just launched one program at a time. And we spoke to the closer member organisations, and we used word of mouth to get the message out there. So it was less about the whole getting into the communities, which is what would have made the biggest impact, to getting into the communities, face-to-face conversations, and explaining to them the benefits of what doing this training is about. Yeah, so in terms of the training, it was very much if you were a volunteer or a paid person, but you're working in a in an organisation that was classed as a social enterprise or a voluntary organisation. So anything that falls under that umbrella, we were quite happy to accommodate. And we have, you know, we've had all sorts of like roles and positions and organisations that have taken part. We've tried to be quite open and flexible. But like I said, because we started with member organisations and the people they were talking about still fell under that sort of umbrella of who we were trying to capture. It's less for businesses, commercial businesses and statutory organisations, but that doesn't mean it won't be one day. But for us, it's very much the training for people that don't normally get training. So it could be anybody who even volunteers for 1 or 2 hours a week, or is interested in sort of improving their prospects to work in the sector. I think in Leicester, the community is quite diverse. There's a lot comes under community, and we've tried to not limit where our reach is, and if it is with something questionable, we've taken on a case-by-case status. So if we're thinking that we're not quite sure if this falls under it, then we've made that decision based on that specific case, not where they're working or what they're doing. And the organisations that we've worked for are doing, like, you know, first-hand services, a lot of them. They're actually interacting with communities, you know, and recently we've had that some of the sports organisations have started to show an interest as well about sort of developing their leadership capacity, and they're working with the youth or they're working with the disabled. And same with these kind of communities that we've had, they're actually face-to-face going out in communities doing the advocacy work as well. And they're going to be the best ambassadors, because if they've seen the benefit of what we're delivering, and it is all about them, you know, we're not getting anything from it. We, you know, we've got funding, but we're still subsidising and delivering as much as we can for free. So I think as far as communities are concerned, it's the more we can get under that umbrella, the more we will try and get them in there. I didn't realise how challenging it was going to be to get those people involved, because I think they make the biggest impact. Actually, their word means a lot more than my word would, because they're talking to the people that it makes a difference to. To me, I'm just symbolise sort of somebody who's delivering a service, but somebody who uses a service and says this service is really good, they're the ones that actually, you know, ambassadors for us, but also reassuring those people that this is worth your time and investment. And the biggest challenge has been at those levels, and you know where I'm really personally passionate about is it's all those people that miss out because they don't fit a certain criteria, because they don't fit a model, or because they're not with the right organization. We want to capture those people because they are the ones that are going to have an impact on where this sector or the community are going to go. We might sit in powerful positions and in authorities thinking we're setting policies, we're setting rules, but actually, if the people don't buy into it and they don't feel emotionally connected to what we're saying to them, that this is what we want to do with Leicester, then it's not going to happen. You know, we can do a movement from the top, but if the people that are grassroots and in the communities and doing the day-to-day, you know, making a difference, if they don't buy into it, it's just empty words, really, isn't it? It's just rules. I think we don't completely understand that yet, because the pandemic has meant we haven't had those close, you know, you know, the conversations that really make a difference and make you understand the impact that you're having. And I found that has been quite a barrier, because having Zoom meetings does formalise it a little bit. You know, your training's a bit more formalised, the conversations are a bit more structured. And like you said about the clapping, you know, I'm all for empowering people and making them feel good and making them feel like, you know, rewarded for what they're doing. But it's also recognising that that's not enough. We can, you know, the, you know, we're saying that we are looking after our employees' well-being. We're looking after the community's well-being. But just saying it, actually, when you dig down, is it really, you know, what is that? What does that look like? And I think that goes with everything that I've come across in the sector is there's a lot of people say they do a lot of things. But when you dig down, you know, what are they actually doing? Are they, you know, because it just, I haven't seen enough evidence to say that what we say is what we do. And that's what I want to change with the leadership. I want the new leaders to come across and the current leaders to say, we're going to do this, this is what we believe, this is what we stand for. And you can see that thread go through the whole organisation or the whole community project or the whole community in itself, which is what we're missing. It's that follow through. You know, I can sit here and say I'm delivering a great, you know, service by offering a project and some training, and it's free and all these great wonderful things, but if we're just ticking boxes and not actually making an impact, well, I'm just the same as everyone else. To me, when I think about Build Back Better, and I haven't really given it that much thought until probably the last few days, and not in the sort of probably in the same way that you look at it, but one of the things is around, before you build back better, you need to review where you're at. And for me, you know, talking as a context of a project manager, I don't think that our foundations are secure enough to build on yet. So, and how do we identify, and, you know, I'm very much speaking about what I've experienced. So actually, you know, maybe it all needs to go back to some really basic measures and some really basic skills that we are really lacking at the moment. And for me, the biggest one is communication. And communication in all different sorts of aspects. First of all, build back better. Who knows about it? I didn't know about it, really. I didn't know any detail. I know it's a slogan, but what does that mean? So we're saying that this is building back better, say, for Leicester, but do Leicester communities actually know what that is? Do they really understand the concept behind it? Do they understand what impact they can have? Do they understand that they can make a difference or that their voice will be heard? How have the people that have put this policy or this movement together, how are they then communicating to those people that really will be impacted by this? And that's from the young that will then become our future leaders to the ones that are current leaders and the ones that are actually doing all the hard work, all the hard graft, and have a real life experience of how the pandemic affected them and how they would like to see improvements and what would have helped if that had been in place back then. And I don't think that we're talking to all the people. So it goes back to communication. How have we communicated the message of what Build Back Better is, and how are we communicating? Who can have that impact? Because there's people sitting there, they don't even know what that is. They don't even know this is happening, and they therefore don't know that they can have a voice in that. So I'm really a big ambassador of going back to communication. How are we communicating that message? You talk about brands and marketing and all this stuff comes out, and actually all they talk about is communication, and how clear is that message, and how are we then going to, how can you measure something when not everyone involved really knows what's happening? So for me, communication is the core, and the other thing is bringing in the people from grassroots level into where some of the decisions come in. There's some really strong leaders out in the community that have really made things happen and really supported through during the pandemic. But are they being involved in some of this decision making and some of this policy setting and some of these guidelines setting? So for me, that those two things, if you could get them in place, then you start thinking about how do you measure it. And the measure would be the fact that we're having a cross-pollination of skills, leaders, and community sort of groups mixing and talking about subjects. And people don't like uncomfortable conversation. They don't, but that's where the magic happens. It's that awkward conversations. And, you know, for leaders, you know, politicians, you know, people from the council, putting themselves in communities where they know they're going to get uncomfortable, they're going to feel uncomfortable, they're going to get challenging questions. But putting yourself in there and answering those questions and making the communities feel like they're being heard and that there's actions going to happen out of that, that's where you're actually going to make the Build Back Better of Leicester, especially, because who really knows what Leicester is? There's a perception of Leicester. So if I think about Leicester, I think about we're very diverse. Everyone knows that. We've got a university, so, you know, De Montfort University, so we're known for that. We've got, you know, a really good football team. But then when you look at the flip side of it, we've also got a high case of stabbings and violence. And youth, you know, youth don't know what to do with themselves. You know, there's unemployment. So it's all right having the nice conversations and recognising all we're doing well and clapping, but actually, what about all the bits that are not so well? How do we fix that? How are we working towards that? And where's that, you know, and I'm not saying there's not work happening there, but where, who's bringing it all together? And for me, that there's just so many missings at the moment. So it's almost like we're trying to get to the end before we've actually done the groundwork. I think, oh God, it's an interesting question because there's so many different avenues you can look at this. So if you're looking at it, obviously I'm completely my opinion, but if you look at it from somebody who's trying to implement this change, there's so many tick boxes that it becomes a process. It's not actually about the change, it's about just getting to the end. And, you know, there's this tendency of how can we get somewhere as quickly as possible, and therefore not everything gets explored. The other reluctance comes from, and the resistance comes from people constantly not being heard to the point that they get to that. I mean, I've felt this several times in my, you know, last few years, like, you know, nobody listens, so why do we keep repeating ourselves? And, you know, and so there's that, and there's people like that say, oh, but we will tell you what we think, but we don't get any credit for it. Somebody else gets credit for it. We don't get any recognition for it. So the community starts, you know, it becomes a them and us. That them and us needs to disappear before actually any change and the resistance starts breaking down. And how do you break that down? You go back to communication. You put yourselves in those situations. You go meet those communities. You talk to those people. You build trust. Without trust, you're never going to make change happen. That goes from anything from, you know, leadership training to actually real life. If you don't trust somebody, you're not going to follow them anywhere. So, and there's always going to be that resistance, and there'll always be naysayers, and it's identifying who are the people that are standing in your way, who are the people that are making everything a negative experience, and it's about winning them over. How are you going to win them over? It's about actually what understanding from them what their perspective is, what is their experience, why are they feeling like this, why are they resisting? Because those stories are actually going to make the difference and understand what building back better is. It's not the sort of, you know, what they call the sound bites and, you know, the what we think or the assumptions. It's actually the stories that you have to pull out for. And it takes somebody quite special to pull out from a story what the actual issue is or what needs to change. It's about getting, it goes back to identifying the right people. Now, you're talking about two different religions not getting, religions or area communities not getting on because of what's happening in a different country. Well, actually, who's going to be that one person? I bet you, if you spoke to both communities separately and found something they both believe in, and then brought up a project or a conversation that they both believed in the same way, that would bring them together. It might not bring them all together, but even if you brought two people together, that's two more than you had before, and you build on that. It's always about change. Is always about building up slowly, because that'll be the best change. Building it up drastically, it'll just collapse at some point. So with communities, and it goes back to talking, people need to get out there and start talking, and the pandemic hasn't helped, because that's just created more distance, and people have become very much their circles of, like, you know, communication and who concern, so to speak, have become really small. And not everyone will be the one that will do that. It's identifying who are those people who, you know, and there might be some volunteers. I bet if you went and asked who wants to come on this journey with me and start talking to some communities, people shoot their hands up. First of all, they want something to do, they want a purpose. Secondly, they want to make a difference. And people aren't bad. People actually want to do good. People want to build bridges. But it's this perception that actually there's this divide. But when you look deep down into it, if everyone's values are the same, if everyone's purpose is joint, then where's the divide? It's just in the media, really, isn't it? And in the narrative that's used, that goes back to the narrative of Leicester. We can have a really positive narrative, or we can have a really negative one. And it's building back better is also, it's like capturing the narrative of Leicester. So what message are we sending outside of Leicester about Leicester, and also tackling what's happening in Leicester. And one of the things that I think about a lot is, because Olympics is an ideal example. So we've just had the Olympics, and we're on a really good run. We were on a really good run with the football. Now we're on a really good run with the Olympics. You know, we're starting to get the goals in. But look at I mean, I'm a bit like you, a bit pessimistic. So you look at the sports people now, they've been conditioned, they've been trained, and they've been put through this rigorous regime and training to deliver a gold, a medal, to get to the Olympics. And so when you've done that, what's next? You know, you've had all this pressure. So it's the same for schools and colleges and universities. You put your students under so much pressure. You give them structure. You say, you need to get up at this time. You need to do this. You need to do this. You need to do this. You're giving them instructions to be able to get to the end goal, which is a degree or a gold medal. Doesn't make any difference. But once they've got that, if you look at the gold medalists, they'll have a coach. They'll have a coach that'll say to them, okay, you've had the euphoria and now you're sort of a bit lost. You don't know what to do because you achieved. So it's like, what's next? You go to university, you get your degree, and now the people are being abandoned, and it goes to college as well. And I've seen this from family. You know, I've got teenage, you know, nephews and nieces and that. They've gone to college, they've gone to university, but so where they've had all this support and this structure, they now don't know what to do. They don't know how to cope with the outside world. So what happens to those people? Why are we not capturing them people and saying, here's a purpose? Why, you know, these are some really good values. Why are we not identifying what those people can do? They've come with skills. When I was younger, you know, I might not have had the education that people are getting now because it just wasn't the thing then. But I still knew what I was. And I think that gets lost in institutions where, you know, but then it's about identifying. And that's where the leaders need to come in, where the communities need to come in and say that, look, we've got this next generation. They actually don't really know what they want to do because they want to make a difference, but they also want to pay their bills. So who's nurturing these people? Who's mentoring them? Who's coaching them? Who's giving them that sort of, direction of where they could be going? And what's going to happen is all this violence, this crime, this unemployment, all that comes from the gap between people leaving an institution and starting a job. And that is, for us, a really valuable sort of area that we as a community and as leaders need to be looking at. What are we doing? What are we offering those people? Sitting and talking, it's not encouraged because it's like, well, you should be working, or you should be doing this, or you should be doing that. But actually, it's the conversations. Back in the day, when there was less pressures and less conforming to society, people used to sit around and chat around cups of tea. And all these tribal leaders and all that, people used to go sit in groups and say to the leader, actually, this is our problem. What's the solution? And the villagers used to come together in a group and do it. Where do we do that here? There's power in something that we used to do back in the day, what used to happen in ancient times. We can learn, and that goes back to going back to the basics. Let's strengthen our foundations before we build better. Better communication with the right people and through the right people, and identifying actually what are people's stories and pulling from that what it is that's actually needed, because no one person has the answer to that.
You've been listening to Leicester Builds Back Better Stories, conversations about how communities across Leicester are planning for change following the pandemic. For further information about each of the topics covered in this program and to hear extended versions of these conversations, visit the Leicester Stories website, leicesterstories.uk. Leicester Stories is supported by the Audio Content Fund and was developed with assistance from De Montfort University, the Documentary Media Centre and the Xynthia Trust. Thanks to Ryan Clayton for additional content production. This is a Decentered Media production by Rob Watson.